Hi, good morning. Today's reading is in Ecclesiastes, chapter 1, verse 1 to 18. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What does man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets, and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, never ever returning to its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ears is full of hearing. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It is here already long ago. It was here before our time. There is no remembrance of men of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. I, the teacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under heaven. What a heavy burden God has laid on man. I have seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, are chasing after the wind. What is twisted cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. I thought to myself, look, I have grown and increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. Then apply myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly. But I learned that this is chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. Thank you.
Good morning. Good morning. How's everyone doing? Wow. Why don't you all shoot yourselves now? Wow, okay. Okay, wait, let's try that. How's everyone doing? Oh, okay. Yeah, top of the world. There we go. I remember a few weeks ago, I talked about how Rosanna loves to come to church. She's always like, oh, I get to go to church. And she's so excited. And I said, oh, I wonder how long that will last. And well, now I know, because yesterday when we said, hey, you don't have to be sad, we get to go to church tomorrow, and she went, I don't want to go to church, I want to go to school, which is good, but, so that didn't last too long. Yes, so has anyone read the title of the sermon today? Right? The Shadow of the Antichrist. Ooh. This sermon's actually inspired by Anthony Yan and Daniel Alexander from my conversation with them on Wednesday. So, yeah. So what do I mean by Shadow of the Antichrist? Well, we're not going to talk about the end times. We're not going to talk about the Antichrist. We're not talking about any of that stuff. But we'll get to what I mean by the Shadow of the Antichrist later in the sermon. And actually, you know, last week we did a sermon called Not a Fan, and I'm going to use that sermon as sort of a stepping stone to a new series, which will be called Not a Fan. And this series will basically be exploring things that cause us to be fans of Jesus instead of followers of Jesus. So we're going to look at various different things, and this is week one of that, of one thing that I think, especially in our culture, really causes us not to really want to follow Jesus. So, Ecclesiastes, amazingly popular book because it's so inspirational. Ecclesiastes is traditionally believed to have been written by Solomon. It's the genre of scripture called wisdom literature. And it's the part of scripture that is designed to give you wisdom. If you want to be smart, in theory, you read the wisdom literature. It includes the Psalms, the Proverbs, Song of Song or Solomon, Ecclesiastes, and Job. And these are the wisdom literature, the part of Scripture that imparts practical wisdom for our lives. Everyone is familiar with Psalms, which is beautiful poetry. Then there's Proverbs, which has pithy statements that are very practical. Song of Songs, or Solomon, which is the ultimate love poem. And then there's Job. Who here knows the story of Job? Yeah, people know the story of Job? See, what happens in Job is that in the beginning you have Satan and you have God, and they're up in heaven. And Satan goes, you know that humanity down there? They suck. And God says, wait a minute. Have you met my servant Job? And Satan goes, ha! Job is only a good person because you bless him so much. Of course he's going to love you. And God says, okay, let's have a little bet here. Because let's bet with God because you can win. Anyway, so God makes his bet with Job, that Job will stay loyal even though Satan does all this crazy stuff to him. So they make this bet and Satan goes down. And so Job's just walking around. He's a good guy. And then this servant comes to him and he's like, the Sabaeans, they've come. They've killed all your donkeys. And Job's freaking out. And before he finishes, the servant, another servant comes to him and says, Job, the craziest thing happened. The craziest thing. Fire from heaven came and destroyed just everything. And then before that servant finished, another servant comes and says, Job, the Chaldeans raided from the east, stole the camels, and killed your servants. And then before that servant finished, another servant comes and says, Job, all your family, they were all in your oldest son's house eating lunch, and wind struck the house, and the house collapsed, and all your children are dead. And at this point, Job's just like, ah! And he makes a famous statement, which most people know. Naked I come from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And then Job's wife comes up to him and says, who are you? Curse God and die, you fool. And that's when Job says, God, give me back the camels, take the woman. Actually, I don't think he said that. But Job refuses. So Satan goes up to heaven again, and God's like, see, I'm God, told ya. And Satan goes, no. He still has his health. You give me his health, and he will rebuke you. And God says, okay, you can take his health. Just don't take his life. And so Satan goes down and gives Job these horrible boils, and it's awful, and it's painful, and these dogs come, and they're licking the boils. And can you imagine that? Of a boil, just some, like, thing growing out of you. And you're in all these pains, and these dogs are licking pus off of you. And dogs weren't necessarily, you know, all like Lassie and all that back then. And they're not clean like they are now. They're dogs that are dogs, right? And Job's life is just not very good right now. There is kind of a semi-happy ending to Job's life, but I won't talk about that right now. And just as a note, the best illustration that I can give for this sermon that I'm about to give you is the story of Bambi. Has anyone ever seen Bambi? Yeah? If you haven't seen it, I'm going to ruin it. Bambi's kind of sad, actually. It begins with this cute little Bambi, and he's born, and he's kind, and stumbling, and it's so beautiful, right? And his mother's so kind and nice, and she loves him. She's taking care of him. And then the evil humankind comes and blows her away for sport. It's really depressing. And the first time I saw it, I was like, what? Because I didn't see it until it was much later, older, actually. You can't do that. It's Disney. And if you get really sad during this sermon, just think of Bambi. Now, so that's the warning. Now, people who have Job-like experiences, people who have experiences like Job, think that, you know what? If I was just healed, life would be great. If I just had more money, life would be great. If I just had children, life would be great. If I just won the Rugby World Cup, life would be great. If I was just part of something big and important, life would be amazing. If my parents didn't die, if I didn't have cancer, if I wasn't abused as a child, if I wasn't if, then life would be great. Life would be amazing. Life would be perfect. And the problem with that idea is the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 1. The words of the teacher. Out of the gate, Solomon wants to teach us something. This is his magnum opus. These are his memoirs. This is something that he thinks is very important that we as the people of God need to know. And he goes on, the words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. This is Solomon. And what's something that you know about Solomon? He's rich. He's wealthy. He's smart. He's good looking. He's got everything. He's richer and more powerful than you will ever, 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 ever be. Verse 2. Meaningless, meaningless. Or just lots of meaningless. He just keeps using that word, meaningless, or vanity of vanities in other translations. Everything, Solomon, we ask, is everything meaningless? Marriage? Yep, meaningless. Rugby? Meaningless. Love? Meaningless. Pleasure? Meaningless. Power? Meaningless. He's not saying, here's some things I don't like. Here's some things that I think are just kind of stupid. No, he's saying everything is meaningless. Then we continue on to verse 3. What does humanity gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? I mean, this is why life in a nutshell is meaningless. I mean, you get up in the morning, 5 a.m., 6 a.m., or you sleep in till 10, and then you do your thing, and then you go to bed, and nothing's different. Nothing's changed. And you just keep on doing that over and over and over and over again. Now, verses 4 to 7 says, generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, and yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. What is he saying? He's basically saying that life is like a treadmill. That's all life is. It's like laundry. I do the laundry sometimes, very, very rarely. Charlotte usually doesn't. Thank you, Charlotte, she's awesome. But guess what? A week later, we've got to do laundry again. Haircuts. Just a few weeks ago, I needed a haircut really bad. Maybe I need another one. And so I went out and I got my haircut. But guess what? In a couple of months, I'll need a haircut again. That's how life goes. It's a treadmill, a cycle, and it's meaningless. So let's go to verse 8. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear is its fill of hearing. I used this illustration, actually, the very first sermon I ever gave last June. I used this exact illustration, so if it seems familiar, maybe that's why. Let me just sum up what most of our days are like. So, morning, let's say. And just think about how much your life has changed since I first preached. Tomorrow morning, our alarms will go off at 6:30, let's say. We'll shower, get dressed, get in our car to go to work. Stop to get a coffee, absolute necessity. We'll sit in traffic. You'll get to your office, your cubicle, your workstation. You'll work until lunch, probably with some friends. And then after lunch, you'll go back to your workspace, cubicle, office, school, shop, whatever. You'll get off at 5 or 6. Then you'll leave. Maybe you'll go to the gym. Probably not. You want to. You know you should, but you're tired. You'll go home. Have supper, hang out with your family, friends, kids, watch a movie, a TV show, play a game or something, and you'll just do it all over again, every day, over and over and over and over again. It's like we live that great movie, Groundhog Day. If you haven't seen that movie, see it. See The Princess Bride first. We try to pretend our lives have some meaning. We try to pretend we're not just in a completely predictable rut. But really, when you think about it, it's just the same thing over and over and over again. So let's look at verses 9 and 10. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was here already long ago. It was here before our time. People try to pretend their life isn't meaningless, that they're not in a predictable rut. We all try it. And how do they do it? How do we do it? What is the number one thing we do to not think our lives are absolutely meaningless? Stuff. Little things. And Solomon says, though, while the trinkets might add more color to our lives, they don't add anything new. It's funny how obsessed we get over trinkets. You know, when I got my iPhone 4S, I suddenly felt like a better person. You know, I would just take it out just to check the time, but really I was taking it out so that people would know I had an iPhone 4S. We get meaning from meaningless things, from plastic and bits of circuit, and from cars, which are just a bunch of metal stuck together. They break down all the time, and we try to get meaning from them. It's crazy. Now, don't get me wrong. There's some glory that we get from having things that look nice. For example, I have a car. It's pretty banged up because I can't drive properly. But I have a car, and that's a 1996 Nissan Laurel. And when I pull up in the parking space out front and get out of the car, no one comes up to me and says, ooh, nice ride. Can I touch it? Can I sit in it? I don't get that. I just don't. Now, if I pulled up in a Ferrari or a Lamborghini, people would be like, yeah, Mark, whoa, I want to go to your church. Wow. You know, like, whew, right? There is some glory with that. But now the funny thing is that when you die, you don't get to take that with you. When you get to heaven, it's not like God will say, Mark, you had a sweet car. Come, let me introduce you to Paul. Well, and Peter, come here. This is Mark. He had a sweet car. That's not how it plays out. You don't get to take this stuff with you. And at the end of the day, it's meaningless anyway. Does anyone hear of a Walkman? I mean like a Walkman. I mean like the cassette tape Walkman, right? Anyone young enough not to know what a Walkman is? Most people are old enough, I think. Yeah. At some point in history, a Walkman was the number one thing in the world. You would get this Walkman and people would be like, oh my goodness, you have a Walkman! Can I touch you? Right? It would be like, let's go over to Mark's house because he has a Walkman! Today, not so much. When I was younger, my dad got us our first computer. I was pretty old when we got our first computer, but it was new when I got it. And what he got was a DX486-100. It wasn't even Pentium yet. You probably don't even know what that is. I mean, my iPhone is about a gajillion times more powerful. This computer had 100, not 2.2 gigs or something, 100 megahertz of speed. 100 megahertz. You know, your watch has 100, I don't know. It had 8 megabytes, 8 megs of RAM, 8 megs. My laptop has 8 gigs. That's 8,000 megs. Yet that time, that was a smoking fast computer. I went to school and I was like, I have a DX486-100. And people were like, whoa! Like, I'm not joking. People were mind boggled. And people were like, you can run the latest games, like Pong. And that was just some really happening stuff. And right now, it's junk. On TradeMe, they're selling cheap computers that are about 100 trillion times better than the computer my dad bought 15 years ago for like $3,000, and they're only a few hundred bucks. And yet we've become so caught up with this stuff. Youth and young adults, right? We're obsessed with fashion. You need the latest clothes, right? When I was younger, I had these acid jeans. It was really popular to have acid jeans in the 80s. The downside is I had them in the 90s. And I got made fun of all the time. But at some point, they were cool. This is how everything works. All clothes we're wearing, all the cars we're driving, everything is really meaningless because it's all going to the trash heap. And yet we put meaning in our lives by trying to get more of this stuff. Trying to get the big house, the big car, the big trips, all this stuff. And yet it is all meaningless. You deceive yourself. You deceive yourself, just to be blunt, by trying to get meaning out of this stuff. Verse 11. There is no remembrance of men of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. It's just going to get more depressing here. Solomon's basically saying, you know you're going to die, and no one's going to remember you. Who here remembers their great, 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 great grandfather? The name? No? It wasn't too long ago. How about your great, 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 great grandfather? Great, great, great grandfather? Great, great grandfather? Great grandfather? Grandfather? Yeah, okay. Right? No one's going to remember you. Not necessarily, even if you're a super famous person. For example, Tertullian. Some of you know who that is? Anyone? Good job, Rob. But some of you are just like, that's the worst name I've ever heard. Why would I remember that name? He was an important guy, very important guy in the early church, in early church history. But you don't remember him. We're all going to die, and no one's going to care 100 years from now. Your whole life and everything you do will be meaningless because you're going to die. Everyone you've helped, they'll die. Everyone they help because you help them, they will die. In 100 years from now, over 6 billion people will be dead, and no one will remember any of them. That's what Solomon is saying here. You know, about 150,000 people die each day. And so about 150,000 people died yesterday. And the same way you cared about those 150,000 people will be the same way 99.9999999% of humanity will care about you when you die. It's the honest truth. Verse 12 and 13. I, the teacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under heaven. What he's saying here is that he's the king, he has access to resources, and he wants to find out what the meaning of life is. He's going to go out, he's going to use his five senses, and he's going to try everything. And at this point, it's all meaningless, and that's kind of depressing. So he wants to go out there and test his hypothesis. He wants to find out if everything is really meaningless. So what does he do? Let's jump to verse 16. I thought to myself, look, I have grown and increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. Basically, he's saying, you think I'm a liar? I'm smarter than all you fools. I'm King Solomon. I'm one of the smartest people who ever lived. A little bit arrogant, but that's what he's saying. Verse 17. And then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly. But I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. This did. First he went the high route. I don't know how you say it here. First he ate the caviar. He got the Lamborghinis. He got the mansions. He got the women. He had lots of women. He traveled on his yacht in Montego in the Caribbean. He did the high life, the life everyone wants. Nothing. It was empty. Unsatisfying. It was meaningless. Because guess what? Bam! I'm dead, and it's over. So then he thought to himself that maybe he had to go the other route. Maybe he had to go poor, right? So he gets all redneck, right? He got the pickup truck. He watched rugby with his beer. He went out, killed an animal, ate it raw, used the outhouse. He just went the other route. Conclusion? Meaningless. It's funny because rich people think if life was just a bit simpler, life would be grand. And poor people think if I just had money, life would be amazing. Nope. Solomon tried it all and saw that all of it is meaningless. Now you're going, man, Mark, I thought church was supposed to be happy. Some of you are actually going, though, hey, this is great. When my wife asks me to mow the lawn, all I have to do is say, remember what Pastor Mark said this Sunday? It's meaningless. You're going, yeah, I get out of jail free card. But what's the deal here? Why am I preaching this? Because instead of choosing the one thing of value, the one thing that gives value to everything else, God, people choose other stuff. And I wanted to explain to you what that other stuff is. It's meaningless. Solomon's laying it out that if you try to gain meaning or satisfaction or hope or anything out of this life that doesn't involve God and Jesus Christ, you're just choosing something that is absolutely, at the end of the day, meaningless. You may be non-Christian and you may get the best job in the world. You may become the new owner of Microsoft, Facebook. You may become the president of the United States, win a Nobel Peace Prize for doing nothing. You may get everything. But in 150 years, who's going to care? We had Tiny Toons here. We had a fundraiser, and we had a trivia portion, and I asked a question. I asked, and it was Kiwis, there was immigrants, the whole spectrum of New Zealand society was in this room, and I said, as a trivia question, who was the first prime minister of New Zealand? You know how many people knew the answer? No one! No one knew the answer! I can't comprehend that. I mean, maybe in North America we drill our leaders a bit more, but in case you don't know, Henry Sewell was the first prime minister of New Zealand, but no one cares. I mean, do you really care? Does that affect what you had for breakfast this morning? No, you don't care. Even if you're one of those really famous people like George Washington or Michael Jackson, even these people who are really famous and who we really look high upon for whatever reason, do you think they care? Do you think Washington cares that there's a city and a state named after him? He's dead. It didn't affect his life, and it won't affect your life once you're dead. But you might say, and this I hear this a lot, but you might say, especially in Chinese church, I want a good life for my kids. Well, guess what? Your kids are going to die. My kids are going to die. Their kids are going to die. And their kids are going to die. And one day the sun's going to explode and everything's going to die. And the universe is going to experience heat death and done. It's depressing. It is. If you really like think about it, for a second, which no one ever does because we're all distracted by Diablo and TV and all sorts of... Diablo, interesting, that means Satan. Anyway, that was for free. So it's depressing. But what's funny is that so many people choose that. Not the microphone. There's the good news, and then there's the ridiculous, totally stupid news, and so many people choose the stupid news. But that's what sin does. It makes us think that these things, our iPods, our iPhones, our Porsches, have meaning and value. It tricks us. It deceives us. Like the serpent in the garden deceived Eve. And we are deceived every day through movies, through TV shows that try to teach us to find that person whom we really love and who really loves us. But that person will die, okay? What if you get all this great stuff? You get the iPhone and the wife, the hot wife, not just the normal wife, the hot, smoking Charlotte wife, right? right? You got Porsches, big tree, you got a ring, people kissing it, everything. Let's say you have everything you want. And then you get cancer. And you suffer for 5 years in agony, and then you die. You won't care that you had the best iPhone. It frequently takes a deathbed for a person to evaluate themselves and say, what did I do with my life? I just want to encourage you that if you're being tempted by these other things in the world, that they're meaningless. It's the dumbest choice in the world. It's like ice cream, horse dung. Ice cream, horse dung. I don't know how I can be more blunt. And yet, in the gospel, we have the good news of Jesus Christ. We have hope. We have salvation. We have an eternity of glory awaiting. It's not really a choice. What do I mean by the shadow of the Antichrist? philosopher I really appreciate, not because I agree with him on anything, but because he was brutally honest, is Nietzsche. The famous nihilist. Nihilism is just a realization that life is meaningless. He realized that if Christianity was false and if all religion was false, then life was ultimately meaningless. And he especially hated Christianity. In one of his writings, he referred to himself as an antichrist. One of his writings is the Antichrist, in reference to himself. More in the sense of an anti-Christian, not as some big evil ruler that was going to like destroy the earth, but just as an antichrist, as someone who has specifically defined himself as, I'm completely against the message of Christ. And many of us choose to live in Nietzsche's shadow. Our culture is actually heavily influenced by Nietzsche. He's one of the founding fathers of postmodernism, which is the defining paradigm of how we view the world today. And instead of the gospel of Christ, we choose to live in the gospel of the shadow of the Antichrist. But what are the consequences of the shadow? Do you really understand the gravity of the alternatives before us? For if God exists, then there is hope for humanity. But if God does not exist, then all we're left with is despair. Do you understand? Do you really understand why the question of God's existence is so vital to humanity? As a writer has aptly put it, if God is dead, then humanity is dead too. And unfortunately, the mass of humankind do not realize this fact. They continue on, though nothing has changed. I'm reminded of Nietzsche's story from section 125 of The Gay Science. It meant something different back then. Entitled, The Madman. So who in the early morning, so I'm just going to tell you the story, who in the early morning hours burst into the marketplace, lantern in hand, like a flashlight, like a torch, crying, I seek God! I seek God! And since many of those standing about did not believe in God, he provoked much laughter. Did God get lost? They taunted him. Or is he hiding? Or maybe he has gone on a voyage or emigrated. And thus they yelled and laughed at the madman. Then writes Nietzsche, the madman turned in their midst and pierced them with his eyes. Whither is God? Where is God? He cried. I shall tell you. We have killed him. You and I, all of us are his murderers. But how have we done this? How were we able to drink up the sea? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What did we do when we unchained this earth from its sun? Whither is it moving now? Where is it moving now? Away from all suns. Are we not plunging continually, backward, sideward, forward, in all directions? Is there any up or down left? Are we not strain as though an infinite nothing? Do we not feel the breath of empty space? Has it not become colder? Is not night and more night coming on all the while? Must not lanterns be lit in the morning? Do we not hear anything yet of the noise of the grave diggers who are burying God? God is dead, and we have killed him. How shall we, the murderers of all murderers, comfort ourselves? And the crowd stared at the madman in silence and astonishment. At last, he dashed his lantern on the ground. I've come too early, he said. This tremendous event is still on its way. It has not yet reached the ears of humanity. See, humanity did not truly comprehend the consequences of what they had done in killing God. But Nietzsche predicted that someday people would realize the implications of their atheism. And this realization would usher in the age of nihilism, the destruction of all meaning and value in life. And most people still do not reflect on the consequences of atheism, of non-belief. They don't. And this was Nietzsche's point. Europe had begun to kill God, but they didn't realize. They were still living as if God existed, as if there still was meaning in life. They still lived that way, but they didn't realize the consequences of what they were doing. It's like young children who kill their parents or something like that. They don't realize the magnitude of what they've just done when they do that. So most people still do not reflect on these consequences. Like the crowd in the marketplace, we go unknowingly on our ways. But when we realize, as did Nietzsche, what atheism, what non-belief really implies, then this question presses hard upon us. How shall we, the murderers of all murderers, comfort ourselves? And so, as Solomon pointed out, as Nietzsche has pointed out, when we focus on the things of this world, it's just a pathway to destruction. That's the gospel of the Antichrist. I mean, in not the big evil left behind Antichrist, but just it's the spirit of this age, the spirit of this world, the material world. We need more stuff. We need that woman or man to make us complete. I need more sex. I need more pornography. I need more games. I need more all. I need this, and then I'll be happy. No, you won't. You won't be happy. Never. You'll be empty till the day you die. And yet God, in his great mercy, has entered into our world out of his great love, showed us the purpose, showed us why we're here, showed us the freedom that we have, the glory that there is in this universe, that we can actually look into the sky and be amazed at the wondrous handiwork of our Creator. So I'm going to close in prayer, and I just encourage anyone here who is asking, what is this Jesus thing? What is this gospel? Because it sounds at least a little bit better than everything you just said. I just encourage you to really consider this gospel. Pick up a New Testament, read the Gospel of John, talk to someone. I encourage you, learn about this Jesus person, because he is amazing. And it's not easy to follow him, but I think it will open your eyes to a whole new world of possibilities that you maybe didn't notice before. Lord God, I just thank you for today. Thank you for the good news we have in your gospel, Lord. I just pray that those of us here who are Christians, who get snared by the things of this world, Lord, that we realize that it's truly a distraction. It's truly the gospel of the Antichrist. To just worship the stuff, to just be addicted to the stuff, Lord. And I just pray that us as Christians, that we would just move beyond that. We would rebuke that mentality, Lord, and that we would seek the things of you. And that those of us here, Lord, that are non-Christians, Lord, I just pray that we would do the beauty in your gospel, Lord, and that we would realize that even this world is very dark, it doesn't have to be viewed that way. And so I just thank you for the non-Christians here, Lord. I just thank you for bringing them here, Lord. And I just, it's such a pleasure and a privilege to have them here today with us. So I just thank you again for your creation, for your gospel, for your son, Jesus Christ. And in your name we pray, amen.